Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Today we tackle one of the most vexing issues facing New Mexico, our lack of water. And we do so with the chair of President Clinton's Special Commission on Western Water, UNM Law Professor Denise Fort. Denise Fort, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Denise, what I'd like to do is concentrate on three areas. One, the first area, how bad really is our current water situation? Two, how is it possible that the general public only uses about 10% of our water, and who's using the rest of it? And then three, how do we get, or is it possible to get, to sustainable water use in New Mexico? All right, those three areas.
Great.
So turning to the first area, how would you characterize or assess the current water situation in New Mexico?
I'm in a lot of different settings where people will say it's a crisis or it's not a crisis, and I suppose that we are going to live with the water situation we have, and we need to understand how we can live with, you know, obviously and living in an arid state and in a state where likely climate change will have an effect on our water resources as well. So we have to learn how we live within those resources and how we live in a way that enables us to pass things on to the next generation. But I think in particular places, one could say there are water crises happening at different times. Maybe if one thinks of a subdivision that's been built depending on a certain amount of groundwater, and it turns out that there's less groundwater available than the subdivision had thought. And so within that community, there will be a crisis. There are crises of communities where their water treatment facilities aren't working or where their sewage treatment facilities aren't working. And so we periodically will have things that very definitely look like a crisis.
Well, my general impression is that water demand exceeds supply in New Mexico. There's more people wanting water than there is water.
Well, but we could say that about any resource, couldn't we? And I think that turns us to the question of, you know, we could say that about oil, for example. And if oil were free, we'd probably all want more gasoline than there is, but when we pay for things, you know, we'll have a market. We'll step in, and it'll establish, you know, here's how we live within the market. So, yes, everybody in the state and every sector within the state probably wants more water than they have. But I think the real question is, how do we manage demand? What do we have to do, as we have done in the case of utilities, as we've done in the case of oil and other things that people want to buy? How do we actually manage that demand? And we haven't done a very good job in the state at managing demand. And we tend to think there's not enough water, let's get some more. Well, where's some more going to come from?
Well, when I was preparing for the show, a lot of people said, well, you know, why don't you get water from the Mississippi River or from the Great Lakes or from Canada? Or is that simply, my understanding is that really isn't possible.
Well, you know, I think Governor Richardson, when he was running for president, said something about getting more water from the Great Lakes. And it was just a matter of months later when the different states in the Great Lakes successfully got legislation protecting the Great Lakes. And that could be said of the Columbia River. There was a time when states in California and other Pacific Coast states said we'd like some extra water from the Columbia River, but it didn't look extra to the people in the Columbia River. And indeed, I don't think there's any water source in which there's not a local community of interest that will fight to protect that water source. So we may, you know, there are certainly water transfers taking place, but they're not going to be, you know, just a free, here's some extra water sitting around in which no one else has an interest.
Well, how are we doing, for example, on our interstate compacts, our obligations to supply water to Texas and to, say, the country of Mexico?
Well, the state has, of course, an obligation to meet the requirements of the interstate compacts and of the treaty. The United States has an obligation with respect to the treaty. I think that the kind of interesting question with respect to all of those is that they were negotiated at times when there was a limited understanding, perhaps, of the natural systems in terms of how much water was available and what sort of variations or variability there might be due to, drought cycles and so on. And secondly, they were negotiated at times when the population was really different. And so when the treaty with Mexico was negotiated, I think there were 20,000 people in Ciudad Juarez. And it's hard to make the claim that the water as it was allocated then was necessarily the best allocation for all time. So I think actually with respect to interstate compacts and treaties, we have to have more flexibility in them to allow changes in response to change conditions.
But is anyone willing to give up? I mean, guess my problem with all this is no one's willing to give up their rights. You know, New Mexico is not going to give up their rights. Mexico wants its rights. Texas wants its rights. Who's going to be flexible and say, you know, I really don't want all the water I'm entitled to?
We can see this on the Colorado River, actually, where you've got some of the very similar dynamics, the states on the lower basin, the Colorado, which include California, Nevada, Arizona, states with very much bigger populations than at the time that compact was negotiated. And what is happening on that river, which is really exciting from a water management, water policy perspective, is the states aren't giving up their rights as such, but they are allowing transfers to take place, leases in effect to take place, so that and they are trading certainty of water for agreements not to contest water rights, for example. So there are, in effect, transfers and softness taking place within these compacts, which would appear to have very hard numbers, because we have to. I mean, we have, you know, an enormous population in Southern California. We've got enormous populations in those other states. And we just can't have balkanization among the states, because it doesn't work in a country that is a federal system as ours is. And happily, that has happened on the Colorado River in the face of some, you know, severe challenges from drought.
Well, and New Mexico actually is one of the fastest growing states in the West. The population of New Mexico is supposed to almost double, I think, by 2050.
2050, yeah.
So where do we stand on how we're doing on the Colorado River compacts? Because we get water indirectly from
We get some, yes, we get some water in that river system. But you know, let me go back to the population growing, because it's kind of a, I guess, a popular misunderstanding that for every additional person who comes here, you know, a certain amount of additional water will be required. And what's going to happen instead is there are going to be transfers from one water use to another water use. And in the case of New Mexico and the other western states, it's usually going to mean it's going to be a transfer from some form of agricultural use to a municipal and industrial use. But it's not the case that every person who comes here means that, you know, the state needs, or because the water isn't there, we're not going to get a certain additional amount. We're going to transfer water from one use to another use, or we're going to be conserve water. For example, in the agricultural sector and in the municipal sector, so there's more water available. But the amount of water available to the state just isn't going to go up particularly.
But is it going to go down? I mean, one of the things you mentioned was global warming. Another thing, there's drought. How do you see those factors impacting New Mexico's water?
From everything I read about climate change and global warming, there will be a negative effect on New Mexico's water. And so how do we deal with, in effect, less water and a hotter, you know, as the earth gets hotter, if you're going to attempt to keep a lawn going, for example, or grow crops, it's going to take more water to do so. And so the demand for water in that sense is going to be higher than it is now. There's going to be less precipitation, and there's going to be less storage of water in the form of snow. There'll be less runoff. So all of those things are going to make managing water much more difficult than it's been, and most people say it hasn't been that easy up to now. But it's only going to get more difficult in the face of climate change.
Is there any way for you to give us a sense of how much, you know, how severe it's going to be? I mean, does anybody put numbers to these things? Like, we'll have 10% less water, or it'll be so much more severe to regulate it, or some sense of what the future is going to be like?
There are scientists who have attached numbers to that within different regions of the state. You know, I think that the precision in the models still isn't there quite enough to say, you know, in this particular area. But we know in general that we're going to be looking at different types of, I mean, I say this all with a sense of great sadness, because I think there's really no good news in climate change for our state. And I think we should do everything we can to stop, as much as we can, to stop the climate change from being as severe as it will be if we don't do something about it. But we know we're going to be looking at a really changed geography within the state. And so that comes back to water management, in which in so many areas of life, I think we want to say there's going to be a new technology that saves us and means this isn't going to be. And I think with respect to water, there are some new technologies. Desalinization is an example of them. Water reuse is an example. But generally, we're going to have to learn how to live with the amount of water we have and to use it more efficiently than we've been using it, and to make sure that we're using it in the places that we consider the most important places to be using it.
Well, let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name's Stephen Spitz, and today we're talking about one of the real problems facing New Mexico, which is we happen to live in a desert. And we're doing so with the chair of President Clinton's Commission on Western Water, UNM Professor Denise Ford. And so let's move on then to this management point that you make. And I guess I'd like to start with the fact that was kind of surprising to me, that the public only uses about, according to the state engineer, here are the numbers from the state engineer's website. The public uses 10% of New Mexico's water, irrigated agriculture 77%. Evaporation 7%, and livestock, mining, and general commercial uses 6%. So I was sort of surprised that even though the population of New Mexico has doubled in the last 50 years, you know, the public's only using 10%. And yet I don't have the impression that we're conserving water all that well as a public.
So that municipal and industrial sector is a pretty small percentage
The
state's water is consumed, and agriculture is a much, much larger number. And, you know, this is true across the western states, and with Nevada as the big exception. You just don't see a lot of agriculture in Nevada. But, in general, in the western states, you see a lot of agriculture because that's where water rights were first established around the turn of the previous century. And those are, you know, the kind of the traditional practices of the irrigated agriculture and so on. And I think that most Western states are assuming there will be some form of transfer from those irrigated agricultural lands to municipalities. But there's a lot of resistance to that in this state and in other Western states on all sorts of different grounds.
Well, let me ask you sort of a fundamental question about what I think about water management, which is how much do municipal users actually pay for water?
They pay much more than irrigated agriculture tends to pay. And there's lots of reasons. One of the reasons is that, water rights were established when water rights were initially established, they largely went to agriculture. So those interests already own the water. And in our municipal systems, what we're really paying for is not so much the water as such, but the distribution of water, the treatment of water, for drinking water standards, the distribution of it around a city, the waste, the treatment as it comes out through a sewage treatment plant. And we would tend to, when we use water in the Southwest, about half of the water that we use, we're using for our outdoor irrigation, for our lawns and our trees and so on, everything else.
This is part of the public use, keeping. The 10%.
That's part of, a lot of our water is being used. So if we compare the per gallon per day consumption of somebody who lives in New Mexico with someone who lives in Maryland, we use more water per day because we have to keep our, keep our trees alive or something like that. We just, that doubles our water consumption. And so the question that about the cost of water, from kind of an economist's point of view, they're trying to figure out how can one price water so that we cause people to think about what types of trees they want to plant, whether they want to have a lawn and so on. And the same in the irrigated agricultural sector, should there be some sort of water pricing?
Well, haven't some places actually tried to price water? For example, Bel Air, Texas, or San Diego, or Perth, Australia, haven't they initiated some kind of pricing model, and has that had any effect on water usage?
It does. Water pricing does have an effect, and pricing can happen either through, it could be a tax, for example, or it could be a price imposed by the entity that does the distribution. There are lots of different ways it could happen. It can even, in effect, happen if you've got a market in water so that, agricultural water can be used for one purpose or sold to a municipal entity. And anytime you do those things, then you find that the water is used, either entities will conserve water, they might grow higher value crops with the water because there's more of a charge. But there is pricing does make a difference for agricultural water consumption. It makes some difference for municipal entities, but not as much as it does on the agricultural side. And so pricing is one way to affect use of water, and water transfers, which would be the free market ability of an entity to say, I choose to lease some of my water or sell some of my water. But we're not doing much in the state by way of pricing, and we're not doing much in our market. We have some markets for water, but we don't have a, you know, it's not like you can go, you know, pick up the newspaper and buy a few acre feet of water on any given day. We don't have a market that works like that.
You mentioned earlier that you thought that municipal users actually pay more for the water itself than irrigated agriculture does. And my understanding is that irrigated agriculture pays essentially nothing for the water. They only pay for the process, the end product, the last mile, so to speak, the irrigation process. They don't pay anything for the dams or the management or the planning or anything to get the water to the last mile.
And that's, again, I think it just going back to, there's some wonderful books about this, but one of the ones I always have my classes read is Cadillac Desert, which really describes how those projects were built across the western United States. And this was the Reclamation Act of 1902.
This was the public policy that encouraged this.
It was, and the federal government paid for them, and if there was to be any repayment by the beneficiaries, it was at a zero interest rate and over a very long period of time. So there was a lot of water subsidies. But, you know, we're still subsidizing lots and lots of water projects within the state. Many of them now are being subsidized for municipal governments as well as for the initial agricultural users. And we have to ask the question, if we all paid the full price of water, we probably would build fewer projects and use less water than we do now.
Yeah, I mean, if I go into a bar and I don't have to pay anything for my beer, I'm probably going to have more beer than if I have to pay.
I dare say. Yes.
Yeah, right. So I mean, that seems to kind of be a silver bullet that's not being used. If we're worried about the scarcity of water, why not impose some kind of charge to municipal users and agricultural users and let that have some kind of effect, let people then make decisions on how much water they want to use? I mean, to me, that seems like the most obvious, beginning point.
You're probably not going to run for office anytime soon. So the Tucson City Council famously did some, pretty severe water conservation measures and water pricing, and they all lost their jobs and, as elected officials. And I think that we are, we're probably just beginning to think in New Mexico about whether we're really helping the public when we go out and get federal money, which has really been the tradition in our state. We go out and we seek federal money to build a water project. And what we are doing when we do that, in effect, is, yes, we're giving kind of a good thing for the people who might benefit, but we might also be leading people to make decisions that don't really make sense in the long term. I've been opposing a project on the Gila River, which is our last major undammed river in New Mexico, a beautiful river in the southern part of the state, the southwestern part of the state. And the state government has pursued a federal money to build some sort of diversion facility that would get federal money for it to build the facility, and then we'd get some water rights with that. But the kind of questions we really should be asking, I think, are could we supply those water needs at a lower cost both in terms of money, but also in terms of effect on the environment. And I think our mentality within the state has been, if there's some water and if we can keep it from crossing a state line, or if we can use it within the state, we should do so. And if we can get the federal government to pay for it, we should do so. But over, a period of time, as we're seeing now, that kind of thinking doesn't always lead to good decisions in terms of the changes we've made in our natural environment, the changes we've made in our rivers, and the kind of decisions about where people live and what they use the water for. And so I think a lot of that's catching up with us. But politically, it's pretty hard to say. Most people say we've got a water problem, we should spend more money addressing it. And it sounds, I have on occasion sounded very strange to say, well, I think the worst thing we could do is spend a lot more money on that problem.
Let me ask you just some fundamental questions about irrigated agriculture. How water efficient is it? For example, I understand that some of it, some fair amount of it is lost to evaporation. So you simply, water evaporates from the acequias themselves. Water evaporates from flood-irrigated fields, whereas if you put tapes or tubes in the fields and you have drip irrigation, it's a much more efficient system. On the other hand, I've also heard that, if you do flooded irrigation and you have these acequias, the water feeds into the aquifer and actually recharges it.
Yeah.
And so I have no way really of assessing, how water efficient or inefficient those systems really are.
Well, there are benefits, and if in an odd way, there are some benefits to what we might call wasteful water practices, and this notion of aquifer recharge is definitely one of them. But maybe another way of looking at the question is, can we afford, or can farmers and irrigation interests afford to pay for conservation given the value of the crops? You mentioned earlier, you know, alfalfa being the primary crop that is grown
primary cash crop, I think.
In New Mexico. And,
right.
Of course, we are one of the fifth or sixth in the nation in the dairy industry. We have these very large dairy factory farming for dairy cattle.
And
in
do
the
they
state.
Need water? Do they?
Well, they both use water, but they also use the alfalfa. And
oh,
so they're the market for alfalfa. And so there are so many things to untangle here. I think in part of it, of course, are the values in the state of those who want to see certain types of agriculture in the state, those who, you know, want to see water use continue to be controlled by some interests and not in other interests. A mm-hmm. lot of different things that goes into it. I think we can safely say that if water costs more money, you would see it being used, you know, more efficiently and perhaps in different crops than it is used in now, because there would be, we've seen this in California as the cost of water has gone up and farmers have turned to higher value crops in return.
Do you see any prospect of that happening, that pricing or charging would actually be brought into both, you know, irrigated agriculture or commercial use or municipal use? Is anybody talking about this? Because I don't see anybody.
Well, we you know, of course, we're paying at a municipal level. We do pay for our water. In Santa Fe, we're seeing our water rates go way up as we're paying for using some new Colorado River water in
right.
the Buckman Diversion Project. And we're having a sharp increase in water rates that were already quite high. And so, you know, at the municipal side, there is a movement towards paying more. And you'll see a little conservation coming out of that. I mean, people who have had a lawn will start taking the lawns out. But I think the real pressure is going to come from water transfers more perhaps than from, you know, I might wish it'd be otherwise, but I'm not sure that water pricing has the political, it really, really has the political chance.
Is there any legal problem with pricing? I mean, one of the things about these irrigated agriculture people is they have the rights. I mean, they established their rights, you know,
well,
yeah. 200 years ago. And supposedly, you know, they have first rights. Is there anything that would prohibit the state from charging?
Well, you know, if you ask a opinionated law professor a question, I'm afraid I'd give you an answer which would say, no, there isn't a legal problem, not with charging for water per se, but with taxing water, for example. You know, the state taxes the severance of coal, the severance of oil and gas. The state doesn't own those resources, but they are, well, you know, they are, we arguably own the water belongs to the state, and we can certainly charge those who sever or use it in the form of a tax. So there would not be a legal problem with imposing a tax on the withdrawal of water.
Okay. Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm talking to UNM Law Professor Denise Ford, who's an expert on water. And I want to get to the sustainability question. And you indicated earlier, you think it's a question of managing demand. And I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. How do we manage demand to get to sustainability?
Well, I think we haven't agreed in the state, and I think one of the things we attempted to do on this advisory commission, and I think we also need to do within the state, is to say, is sustainability our goal? I mean, you can look in vain in our, you know, our legislative acts that control water to find anyone expressing sustainability. I think
what does sustainability
yes,
mean?
Yeah, yeah. And so, and some people say we use the term entirely too much without defining it. So, right. Sustainability. The basic idea is that we leave the next generation as much as we have, and so we have, you know, if we have fish species, if we have a variety of wildlife that's dependent on water resources within the state, that we leave, you know, we don't make species extinct. If we've been using groundwater, that we don't just, you know, diminish our groundwater basins so much that there's no water left within them. I mean, the essential idea of sustainability is we live on the earth in such a fashion that we do not make the next generation poorer than this one is.
So how do we manage demand to get to sustainability?
Well, yeah. So if we agreed on sustainability as the goal, we have to do things very differently. And I think one of the things we need to do is to say that we care about natural systems. And we really don't do that within state law at this time. We don't protect rivers as rivers. The Federal Endangered Species Act will protect some species. But in general, there's, you know, we haven't said rivers are really a very important part
of
our
life. So you can over-appropriate a river and all the water, all the wet water would be gone.
You can walk over to the Santa Fe River pretty much any day and you'll see no water in the Santa Fe River. I mean, that's just an example.
But that's a perfect example.
Everybody in the state can think of instances when rivers that used to be abundant and used to have consistent year-round, well, not consistent, but have year-round flows and no longer have any flows at all.
So how do you make that legal change?
Oh, well, that's something that our state and we are attempting, I think particularly through the NGO community, to move towards saying let's look at what's going on in our rivers. Let's figure what kind of water we need to maintain some life within our rivers. And we actually have a state law that allows the state to buy water and to dedicate it for environmental purposes as well as compact compliance, which is the other reason we sometimes need water in our rivers. So we've got to get the natural system back in our water laws, and we have to think about public rights to maintaining that. But, you know, your next question about sustainability, I don't think, you know, I certainly have opinions, but not all the answers about this. I'd like to see a public participation in water decision making.
What do you mean by that, public participation?
Well, water decisions, I think, seem very complicated to many people. And, you know, examples of this, we've just had a couple of water settlements, which are actually now before the Congress, dealing with some settlements of tribal rights, but also some big water projects in different parts of the state. And in general, you don't have, you know, people who might be involved in other types of decisions that government might make often find water projects just too complicated to you know, they're usually consulting firms with engineering expertise. The state government is usually a proponent of doing additional water projects. And it's just hard for the public to take an ownership role in, you know, what direction do we want to go to ensure sustainability? And I think that's what has to change in the first instance, is just to have more involvement by the public in a way that actually makes a difference in the outcome of decisions.
So we involve the public, we educate the public, we say you have interests in this, and then how does the public really alter the decision making?
One example that I think was one of the thorniest ones we have in this state is a lot of the groundwater we use comes from basins where it'll never be replenished. That is, we refer to this as groundwater mining. It's just like mining coal or oil and gas or anything else. You take it out and the water is gone. And so the question as to how quickly should we use up this resource, which is a, you know, really once in the lifetime of the earth, we're not going to have new water created. So I think the public should understand which basins are being mined and should, you know, have enough education and ability to participate in the discussion about how quickly should we draw down those basins, if at all. At this point, I think a lot of people don't even know that when we draw, you know, some of these basins down, they're gone for good, much less have, you know, express an opinion about here's what the rate of drawdown should be.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much, Denise Fort, chair of the President Clinton's Commission on Western Water. I'd like to thank my engineer today, Roman Garcia. The executive producer of this show is Tristan Klum. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM.